stuff. This is not a tumor in the classic sense, or and it's not a endothelial cells, but these are neuroprogenitor cells, human neuroprogenitor cells. So we're going to switch gears here a bit and talk about a sort of different topic, but try and look at some of the similarities between systems. So first off, I'd just like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing at Iowa State University. And it's a collaborative effort, and we've got biologists, including myself, Martin Nielsen Hamilton. On the engineering side, we have Surya Malik Pragada from the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering. And then from the mathematics side, we have Howard Levine and Mike Smiley. And Howard's going to take a little bit of time at the end and tell you a little bit about some of the preliminary modeling that we're doing on these systems. So there are some common mechanisms of nerve and blood vessel wiring. This is a figure that was taken from a view in Nature last year. And you can see here on the top panel, these are axons, neuronal growth cones. And this image is taken from the late 1800s by Ramon y Cajal, just classic images using the rudimentary microscope that he had available. But you can see the tremendous detail that he was able to discern from these structures at the growing tips of nerve fibers. And here's a scanning electron micrograph of the growth cone, and you can see these microspikes that many of you have been talking about that are at the tip of the growing blood vessels. And down here we have the blood vessels, and here's a pattern that I think is reminiscent to what many of you have shown in the past several days. And here are the growing tip, and then the cells that are possibly dividing and the proliferating at the backside. So my presentation will be divided into a few parts. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about neurostem cells and talk about it in the context of tissue repair. So we're going to start sort of from a big picture, a macroscopic view of tissue repair, and the ideas of using cell transplantation for that. And then we're going to look at a more defined system, which is in vitro experiments, looking at pattern substrates where we can manipulate the physical environment, chemically modify those substrates with extracellular matrix protein substrates, and then also use biological cues. In this case, we're going to be looking at astrocytes and how they may influence differentiation of these neuroprogenitor and neurostem cells. And then lastly, Howard will tell you a little bit about some of the mathematical modeling of some of these processes that we're trying to address. So a fundamental question in biology that sort of drives our research is, how is the elaborate organization of the mammalian brain orchestrated during development? And sort of another interest is, does in fact, how can we recapitulate this developmental processes under a regenerative scheme in terms of repairing the damaged nervous system? So we proposed to couple the development of mathematical and biological models of neurostem cell migration and differentiation to advance our understanding of pattern formation in general in biology. And we sort of, our philosophy is that we're taking is that mathematical modeling provides a means of testing the robustness of a biological hypothesis. That mathematical modeling, now based on biological and chemical principles, can help us to guide hypothesis building for developing a better understanding of biological systems. And that in turn, development of the mathematical model should be guided by biological observations in this case. So in my lab's interests are in retinal repair strategies, and we're taking a multifactorial approach, trying to optimize survival and function of remaining brain elements, the neurons primarily. Another approach is modulation of trophic influence to promote regeneration. And then the last one is possible replacement of lost cellular elements. So first, just the definition of what a stem cell is. And stem cells are characterized by two very important features. They're often referred to as master cells that can reproduce indefinitely, so they have the ability for self-renewal. And then in addition, these cells are capable, they have to be capable of producing multiple specialized cell types during the process of differentiation. And I think there are two very broad classes of stem cells, embryonic stem cells, and I'll talk a little bit more about those, but we're not working with embryonic stem cells, that are derived either from the blastocyst, and then there's also early stem cells, which are referred to as fetal stem cells. And then the other category are the adult stem cells, which essentially are anything that's derived from postnatal animals as well as adult tissues. And so the work that I'll be discussing today is primarily is working with these adult or postnatal derived stem cells, or neural stem cells. So this diagram just illustrates the hierarchy of stem cellness. And we have at the very top the totipotent zygote, the ultimate stem cell, the fertilized egg, that gives rise to the entire organism. After about 5 to 7 days, depending on the animal, cell division continues and you have a blastocyst. And inside of this blastocyst are a cluster of cells called the inner cell mass. And if you isolate these cells from the inner cell mass and place them in culture, these are referred to as those pluripotent embryonic stem cells that were first terms of human embryonic stem cells that were isolated in the late 90s by Jamie Thompson's group at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So then, what we have are, after that, we have more specialized multipotent stem cells that are, tend to be tissue specific. So here we have a neural stem cell. So this neural stem cell, this multipotent neural stem cell, has to be capable of producing the cell types found within your brain. So the neurons, and then you have two types of glial cells within your brain, astrocytes and oligodendrocytes. So these are sort of the support cells. The oligodendrocytes form the myelin sheath of your central neurons, of the axons and that enwrap the axons. And then the astrocytes serve not only sort of housekeeping, but also structural and then also signaling components, computational components within the brain. But the neurons are the primary ones in terms of signaling information. With respect to the eye, the retina, there's multipotent retinal stem cells that have to be capable of producing the different and diverse cell types found within your eye. And there's at least, there's seven basic classes of cells, six neuronal classes, and then one glial class, which are produced within your eye. And then for each one of these cell types, there are subtypes of cells. So it's a very complicated task for this retinal stem cell. And then over here we have other multipotent stem cells, so hematopoietic stem cells, cardiac stem cells, muscle stem cells, whatever. So
mesoderm.
I'll just sort of categorize that.
You have mesoderm in that circle.
Yeah. Okay, so in terms of stem cells, let's just sort of list some of the possibilities for stem cell-based therapies that are currently going on or also potential for the future. So bone marrow transplants for the treatment of leukemia and other blood-associated diseases have been going on since the mid-60s. And when a patient receives the transplant of bone marrow, there are stem cells within that material that's being transplanted that help repopulate the individual's blood system, hematopoietic system, and so on and so forth. What about the possibility of creating new pancreatic cells for people that suffer from diabetes? That would be tremendous, and there are studies that are ongoing right now trying to do that. The ability to regenerate heart tissue in patients that have suffered severe heart attacks would be phenomenal, and there are studies using transplant of stem cells and hematopoietic bone marrow-derived stem cells for heart attack victims, congenital heart conditions. Repair of damaged spinal cords would be phenomenal if we could use transplantation of stem cells, and there's been a lot of work in animal models that are progressing towards eventually, hopefully, human clinical trials. The replacement of dead or damaged neurons from people suffering from neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease might someday be treated with transplantation of stem cells. Transplants of fetal tissue have been going on, for example, in a number of these neurological disorders, but in terms of stem cells, those studies, at least in the United States, are for the future at this point. And then the ability to restore vision in an individual that's blind. Of course, this is just a partial list. So in terms of central nervous system and eye-related disorders, currently in the United States, there's over 4 million Americans that have Alzheimer's disease. And it's estimated that by the year 2025, worldwide, over 22 million individuals will be suffering from Alzheimer's. Currently in the United States, for Parkinson's disease, there's about 1.5 million people that have Parkinson's disease. Stroke in the United States, about 700,000 individuals. Spinal cord injury, about 500,000 individuals in the United States. MS, multiple sclerosis, about 350,000. And in terms of blindness worldwide, it's estimated that over 30 million individuals suffer from blinding ocular diseases, such as macular degeneration, glaucoma, retinitis pigmentosa, diabetic retinopathy. And it's in the United States, it's estimated that over $175 billion are spent annually not only for the medical treatment associated with these diseases, but also for the family services that are associated with treatment and family home care and things like that. So the bottom line, tremendous biomedical, social, and economic impact associated with these neurological and diseases. So this is what normal vision looks like, okay? Now, in terms of the leading cause of blindness in the developed world is a disease called macular degeneration. And this is what sort of your vision might look like. So the macula at the back of your eye, a region of highest visual acuity, there's some dramatic changes that go on back there. And a few of the speakers have talked about macular degeneration and the invasion of blood vessels and the angiogenesis that's occurring in the back of the eye. And if many of those blood vessels are very weak, you get blood spilling over and you get leading to pretty dramatic deficits in visual function. The second leading cause of blindness in the developed world is a disease called glaucoma. And this would be a sort of an early case of glaucoma. in which case elevated intraocular pressure is a hallmark for development of glaucoma, although people with elevated intraocular pressure do not necessarily have glaucoma, but it is a primary risk factor in the development of glaucoma dysneuropathy. It generally starts from the periphery, vision is lost in the periphery, and then works its way towards the center of the visual field. So this would be sort of a mid-stage glaucoma patient. And then another disease, retinitis pigmentosis, is illustrated here, in which case loss of vision generally occurs in the periphery where you have lots of rods. Your rods are most highly distributed in the periphery of your area, your visual field. Those degenerate, and then gradually, after the rods are lost, the cones are lost, and it can ultimately lead to complete blindness. So let's talk about neural stem cells and neuroprogenitor cells as a possible approach to treat some of these diseases. So neural stem cells are progenitor cells. They're multiple progenitors of neurons and glia. They have to be capable of self-renewal. They've been isolated from not only the developing, but also the adult central nervous system. And these cells are potentially ideal vectors for central nervous system repair. They can be expanded in culture, providing a renewable supply of material for transplantation. And in addition, these cells may be engineered to express exogenous genes for neurotransmitters or neurotrophic growth factors in terms of delivery of those factors, so that they can be used as little mini biofactories for or vehicles for delivery of these substances. So in terms of cell transplant strategies, one approach is to replace or regenerate the neural circuitry. And then another approach that many people are taking is using the transplanted cells as biological vehicles for neural protection. So try and keep the remaining cells alive and happy. I think they don't have to be exclusive, but in fact, I think a better approach is to consider both the combination of one and two. So let me tell you a little about the eye, since we really haven't heard much about it. So here is a cross-section of the eye, the cornea. So people have talked about the cornea as being an environment for some of your experiments. It's a nice model system. So here we have the pupil, the lens, and this yellow band is the neural retina. And here's the optic nerve. Light enters the eye through the cornea, it passes through the lens, is then focused on the back of the eye. And the retina is a part of your central nervous system. It's derived embryonically from the neural tube that gives rise to your brain, so it is a part of the CNS, even though the eye is located out here in the periphery. All vertebrate retinas have the same basic architecture, which will be illustrated. So what we're going to look at is we're going to take a higher magnification view of that area. So this inner retina here corresponds to the inside, and then this pigmented portion out here corresponds to the backside or the outside of your retina, of your eye, the pigmented portion. And the eye is organized into a very distinct cellular and synaptic layer. So we're going to take this so that light enters through all of the cellular material, strikes the photoreceptors, and that's where phototransduction occurs. And now we're going to look at this in a view that I prefer. So we're going to rotate it 90 degrees. So the back side is out here and the inside down here. So what you can see, I hope you can appreciate, that the retina is a highly laminated CNS structure. There are three cellular layers. So first we have down at the inside of the eye, the retinal ganglion cell layer. Then we have the inner nuclear layer, and then the outer nuclear layer. Now these nuclear layers are separated by a synaptic layer. So this is where the synaptic integration occurs. We have the inner plexiform layer there, and then the outer plexiform layer. So once again, light enters, in this example, from the bottom, strikes the photoreceptors. So these photoreceptors out here are very specialized cells. They're designed to receive the electromagnetic energy, the photons of light, and then convert that to an electrical signal. And that occurs out here in the photoreceptors. So the photoreceptors then synapse onto bipolar cells here and send the information from the bipolar cells to the ganglion cell. And the ganglion cell is the only cell in the eye that actually projects outside of the eye. So these ganglion cells have an axon that grows from your eye to your brain. So that's how the information, this light information, is conveyed from your eye, the sensory structure, to your central nervous system. In addition, there are cells that mediate lateral, horizontal interactions within the retina. For example, these horizontal cells and then these amacrine cells. So those cells are involved in shaping the receptive field properties of the retinal ganglion cells. So the synaptic circuitry is also very well understood in terms of the retina and the retinal organization. So the retina is a very nice model central nervous system structure. In addition, because the eye is located out here in the periphery, it's easily accessible for experimental manipulations. Now, in terms of the retinal degenerative diseases that I spoke about earlier, a number of them affect the photoreceptors. So there's an obliteration or a loss or a death of the photoreceptors that will ultimately lead to blindness. Retinitis pigmentosa is a very good example of that. Glaucoma principally affects the inner retina, and that's the ganglion cells. So the ganglion cells are lost in glaucoma. So let's talk about now, we're going to move from talking more about neural stem cells and progenitor cells. Most of the work that I'll be describing for you, we're using cells that have been genetically modified in some way. Either they were derived from GFP transgenic, GFP expressing animals. So here's a green mouse, and essentially all the cells in the animal are expressing the GFP, this green fluorescent protein. So this is ideal for our studies, especially for transplantation, because we can identify the transplanted cells based on their fluorescence, the green fluorescence. In other cases, the cells have been modified ex vivo, genetically modified ex vivo, to express the GFP protein. So here's an example of a green mouse. We can isolate retinal progenitor cells or brain progenitor cells from those animals. And one case, in many cases, these cells will form what we call neural spheres. So each one of these fluorescent spheres here contains anywhere from several hundred to thousands of progenitor cells. Okay? So the dimension here would be on the order of, well, maybe a couple of hundred to 500 microns for that particular neural sphere. So it's contained hundreds to thousands of these progenitor cells. So we can take one of these spheres, dissociate it, plate it onto a piece of substrate, and then add things or remove things from the media, and we can get those cells to begin differentiating. So morphologically, this cell looks sort of like a neuron.
So is each one of those spheres derived from a single progenitor cell, or
no.
Are they generated?
These are not clonally derived. Generally, when you're talking about neural spheres, people try to do clonal analysis with those. Break them apart and plate them out at very low dilution in individual wells and try to track them. But these cells are not very happy when they're separated from neighbors.
What is the source of them, though? I mean, is it inner cell mast cells?
Or no. These particular ones are from the brain. So a neonatal mouse brain, gently dissociated, cultured under very high concentrations of growth factors, basic FGF, EGF, and after several days and weeks, many of the cells will die, but you're left with these tiny little clusters that grow and grow and grow.
So your differentiation is purely chemical then?
Chemical, no. Well,
growth factors.
Yeah.
I mean, supposed to be
removal
chemical.
Of growth factors, essentially,
as
is one
a,
of them.
As opposed to mechanical.
Yes. Yeah. In this case, yes.
Well, aren't you plating them on a surface?
Yeah, they're being plated onto an adhesive substrate.
Yeah, I know, that's fine.
We're not manipulating.
Well, it isn't even intentional. It's the 3D gel environment.
No, this is just in culture.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the GFP labeling. So another thing about this, two things. One, which protein is the GFP attached to? And two, wouldn't it be more useful if the GFP were attached to a protein that only expresses in nerve cells so you can see the differentiation?
Mm-hmm. That would be we as well as others are taking that approach. In this case, it's a beta actin promoter. So almost all the cells in the animal are green in this case. Now, and you're talking about using a cell type specific promoter would be very, very good in terms of looking at specific cell classes. But cells which aren't turning into neurons, for example, are still there, but may not be expressing the GFP because of that. So those types of experiments can be very important for looking at specific cell types and their differentiation. In this case, we just want to know initially what happens to these progenitor cells, which are green, when we transplant them and then ask questions about what they can differentiate into.
So you're trying to distinguish the cells from the donor cells from the recipient.
Exactly. In this case, we're using that to our advantage because we can track the green cells in a non-green environment. So then, in terms of differentiating these cells, we use, here are some neural spheres, but I've also mentioned that we also use other neural stem cells, which rather than being neural spheres, are an apparent population of cells. So these are neural progenitor, neural stem cells growing on an adhesive substrate. We can then take those cells and differentiate them. And then to identify the cell types, one approach is to use specific antibody markers. So in this column, we have the GFP expressing cells that are green. Here's the antibody staining, and then over here is a merged image. So here we're using an antibody against a protein called MAP2, microtubule-associated protein, and here's an antibody called TJ1. So those two antibodies are used as markers for neurons. They will specifically label proteins that are found in neurons. GFAP is a protein that's found specifically in glial cells, so here we're using an antibody that recognizes GFAP. So here we can see the red cell, it's that cell there, and then these other cells over here, did not differentiate and express this GFAP. So this is a pretty effective way to classify the differentiation potential of these progenitor and stem cells. So now let's talk about putting those cells into an eye. All this,
what is the percentage of the purity of those differentiation, the glia versus the neuron?
It varies from population of stem cells to neurostem cells to stem cells. In this particular population, about early on, about 70% will express TUJ1, which is a young neuronal marker. And at that same time point, maybe only 35 to 40% would be expressing a more mature neuronal marker. And then about generally in this particular population, about 5% will be expressing this particular glial marker.
But as you go forward, there will be more glia eventually taking over the culture dish?
We've never seen it completely doing that. So we've always had a significant proportion of cells expressing neuronal markers for this particular population. So let's do the transplants. We're going to be transplanting these rodent progenitor stem cells into rodents, or one of my favorite models is called the Brazilian opossum. So we do intraocular transplants. We bring a microelectrode that contains the progenitor cells here. You then inject them into the posterior segment of the eye. The cells will disperse, glom on to various regions. This is a highly ECM-enriched environment, but then cells can attach to the neural retina. And then we'll take this region and look at it under higher magnification and then analyze it using antibody staining and so on and so forth. So what you're going to be looking at here, just to refresh your memory, intraocular transplants. And all the images that I'm going to show you are 4 weeks after transplantation. So this is a cross-section, a light micrograph of a retina. So here's the ganglion cell there. Here's the inner plexiform layer and the inner nuclear layer out here. The photoreceptors will be up there. So if we now switch to the fluorescence microscopy, here you can see the transplanted cells, which are GFP expressing. And then we'll look at the combined fluorescence and light micrograph. And you can see that the transplanted cells, in many cases, have essentially seamlessly integrated into the tissue and have occupied positions within the neural retina. So this was a transplant into a very young animal. It turns out if you do similar transplants into older animals, you get very little integration. So here's the grafted cells. Here's the neural retina. So this would correspond, that band there would correspond to right there. And you can see in this case, it was transplanted cells into a much more mature environment, and there was very little integration. So one of the things, a question that we're interested in, trying to understand how the host environment can facilitate or stimulate integration of cells.
What's the assumption on the fate of those cells that are in the vitreous humor? Is it just that they're just there and they're not quite sure what they are?
No, they actually will differentiate. So if you use antibody markers, some of those will express neuronal markers, some will express glial markers as well. And the same thing with the cells in here. We find a regional specific expression. So in the few examples where we see expression of photoreceptor-specific proteins, we only see the transplanted cells that are occupying positions in the outer nuclear layer where the photoreceptors are occurring. We never see transplanted cells down here where there are no photoreceptors normally expressing photoreceptor markers. So there's kind of a regional-specific, possibly a regional-specific molecular mechanism that allows for recognition of cues that are there. And I think some of this is a little bit exemplified a little bit more in these next couple of images.
So when you say young, do you mean early postnatal when the retina is actually developing, or
even
subsequent
younger,
to that?
Even younger.
Embryonically?
Fetal. So in this case, we're doing transplants into, so the Brazilian opossum is one of my favorite creatures because it's a small animal about the size of a lab rat. It's a pupsless marsupial, so when the pups are born, they're essentially like embryos. And so we have access for the first 10 days of life of this Brazilian opossum pup to transplant into an embryonic environment. So compared to more conventional mammalian models like mice, rats, cats, primates, the first 10 to 15 days corresponds to an embryonic period of development in these more conventional mammalian model systems. Here's one of my favorite examples, a grafted cell. It's in the ganglion cell layer, and it has these processes emanating within a specific sublamina of the inner plexiform layer. So the inner plexiform layer is subdivided into an off and an on sublamina. So when I turn the lights on, the cells in your eye that are responding to the onset of that light have their synaptic interactions in the on sublamina. When I turn the lights off, the cells in your eyes that are responding to that light being turned off have their synaptic interactions in the off sublamina. So here's a transplanted cell that has its processes restricted to the on sublamina. So it would suggest that when the cell was transplanted, it was invading into the tissue, that it had the ability to recognize some of the environmental cues around it that suggested where it might want to elaborate its processes. This is all conjecture. We don't have any direct evidence for that. So we're going to switch gears now and talk about the in vitro situation. And so some of the questions that we're really interested in is trying to develop mathematical models so we can test the role of the extracellular matrix as well as diffusible factors that may be involved in stimulating the ingression or the migration of the cells from the outside here into the tissue. So some of the things we're going to consider are cell-cell interactions, cell-ECM interactions, growth factors, proteases, lipid proliferation, differentiation, migration, integration. So these are terms that, you know, pretty much everyone has used this week. So although it's a different system, I think some of the issues are going to be similar. So once again, we're going to use an in vitro system where we can modulate the environment. So I just threw in a couple of additional slides just to show you that, in fact, these cells have receptors for the extracellular matrix. So here's an example of a cell that has a glial cell-like morphology. The green is for F-actin, so we're looking at the actin filaments. And then out here, the whitish magenta color, it's a double staining for an integrin receptor subunit, and then an integrin-associated protein. I think in this case it's probably TALEN or vinculin. And then where you have the co-localization of the integrin subunit receptors and the integrin-associated proteins and the termini of the actin filaments, you get this sort of white. So these would be classic focal adhesion structures there. And then here's it's a little washed out here, but a cell that has more of a neuronal morphology, and we're looking at the pattern of expression, in this case, of an integrin receptor subunit, and you can see very punctate staining on the process of these cells. In addition, these cells, we grow them on an extracellular matrix, but in addition, the cells themselves produce a lot of ECM. So here you can see, this is double staining for fibronectin and laminin. So you have this in the reddish, this is a nice fibular pattern of the fibronectin staining all over, and then sort of the green, the more diffuse, is the laminin, antibody staining for laminin. Over here, tenascin, and then here you can see, this would be looking at the ventral surface of the cell, right where it's growing against the substrate, and you can see lots of, chondroitin sulfate staining. So the cells are producing a lot of ECM, they have receptors for the ECM, so it's a very, as you can imagine, a very complex picture. So one of the approaches that we're taking is try to direct the growth of cells, and this not only has implications for just fundamentally in terms of trying to look at ways of influencing differentiation. But in this case, we're interested in the possibility of stimulating aligned growth for the possibility of someday developing conduits for regeneration. So in this case, what I'm showing you here is a pattern. This is a scanning EM. So it's got these maces and then these grooves. The maces are about 13 microns across, the grooves about 16 microns, and elevation of the maces is about 4 microns. So our collaborator, Siri Malakarai, their lab has looked at a variety of dimensions of the pattern, but at the micron level, and have identified approximately a pattern in this with these dimensions as being ideal for directing astrocyte alignment. And so we're then just extended that to look at neural stem cells growing on these pattern substrates. So this is a scanning EM image showing you a smooth substrate, the same cells plated on the smooth substrate versus cells plated onto a patterned substrate. And so the cells over here on the smooth side have very nice radial elongation of their processes, whereas the cells growing over here on the patterned substrate often send processes out, and then the processes will follow and are guided by the maces, the actual physical substrate here. So let's quantify that. And so here's just an image, and I'm using arrows here to denote sort of the vector orientation of individual cells. So here's the pattern substrate, and then these arrows represent the sort of the orientation or elongation of cells on a smooth substrate. So we can count the number of cells growing on a smooth substrate versus a pattern substrate, and we get curves that look bar graphs that look something like this. So everything is in reference to the horizontal, so 0 degrees, the horizontal. So over here we have essentially random orientation for cells that are growing on a non-pattern substrate. And then over here we have the cells that are growing on a pattern substrate. And I think it's pretty immediately you see that the majority of the cells are growing within 20 degrees of the horizontal. So the grooves are aligned horizontally in this case. And so the vast majority of the cells are growing within 20 degrees of that horizontal, 0 degrees.
The cell bodies that look like on your earlier light, they don't seem to be obeying the rule as much though, is that right? So that the protrusions are a
aligning themselves, but cell bodies don't care so much where they land? Is that fair?
Well, the cell bodies will often elongate also, probably here. They'll be in the grooves as well as on the maces, so you see them in both. I'm not sure if that...
I just wonder, it looks to me from here like there, some of the cell bodies are in the grooves and some are on the maces. And, and is that, and whereas their protrusions tend to, I mean, just guessing from looking at that, they tend to be more on the maces. Is that fair or not fair?
We see them both.
Oh.
And in fact, so this, all of these substrates are coated with an ECM molecule.
Both, all surfaces.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. But there's more, it turns out there's actually a little bit more laminin in the grooves compared to the maces.
Just because of drying and stuff?
Yeah. I think surface tension effects, yeah.
So how many days, how many hours is this asset? How long is this asset?
That's about 6 to 7 days after plating the cells onto the substrate. And then we'll see alignment pretty, you know, even earlier than that time period. But it's a convenient time point for doing our assays. And so then we've also looked at differentiation of the cells using those antibody markers that I described earlier. So in this situation, all of our experiments, we have on the same substrate a smooth portion and then the pattern, so we can directly compare cells growing on smooth versus pattern. There's no differences in terms of the media, things like that. But the differences are just in the topography of the substrate. Extracellular matrix ECM coating, either laminin or fibronectin or ECL coats the substrates. So here's an example of a cell growing on a smooth substrate. It has a glial-like morphology stained with GFAP, a glial cell marker. And then over here we have cells that are being stained with a glial marker on the pattern substrate. And you can see the processes are quite, the morphology of these cells are quite different than the morphology of a cell growing on a smooth, flat, non-pattern substrate.
So
also for neurons, similar observation.
So even though you start with laminin by day 6 and 7, do you know what kind of substrate it's really now there since the cells are screening their own? Is it
yeah.
still laminin or is it replaced by something else?
There certainly is some laminin there still, and there's also laminin that's being secreted and fibronectin and other ECM molecules that are being secreted by the cells themselves. So if we used, for example, you know, high concentration of a detergent like Triton, remove soluble membrane proteins and they're just left with ECM components, you'll see
combination.
Yes, yeah, yeah, a complex environment.
So if you have fluorescinated laminin, you can follow the original material versus, have you tried that?
No, that we're doing that. We're actually fluorescinating laminin and want to see exactly what happens to the pre-absorbed laminin and where it goes. So now we're going to complicate the system a little bit and add another player to the picture, and that's astrocytes. So in your brain, you've got more glial cells than neurons. You've got about 10 times more glia than neurons. So, and it turns out that glial cells, like astrocytes, have been shown to facilitate neurogenesis as well as synaptogenesis. So now we're introducing, we've got our pattern physical environment, the pattern substrate versus the smooth substrate, coated with laminin, and then we preplate astrocytes onto that and then sprinkle the neural stem cells on top of that and ask similar questions about alignment and differentiation of the cells. So here you can see in the scanning EM, for example, this region, well, let's look at first on a smooth substrate. This larger cell there is an astrocyte, one over here as well, and these smaller round cells here would be the neural stem cells that were sprinkled on top. So the arrows are pointing to examples of some of those neural stem cells. And then here on the pattern substrate, here you can see part of an astrocyte over here, another astrocyte, part of it up there, and then these would be the stem cells that are sprinkled on top. So if we use antibody markers, once again, to look at these cells.
When you take those skinny images, did you dry out the culture?
Yeah. So that's part of those cracking and things like that is some of the artifact associated with the drying procedures and the coating procedures, yeah. So the top two figures are from a pattern substrate and then the bottom two from a smooth or non-pattern substrate. And we use an antibody, TUJ1, which stains young neurons. And so you can see some cells that are nicely stained. And then over here, what we've also done is use an antibody against a glial cell marker, GFAP. And so the magenta or the purplish would be the astrocytes that are plated beneath. And then the neural progenitor cells were plated on top. And so you can see that this cell, for example, these two cells are nicely aligned. And then here's an example of perhaps two cells that are very tightly opposed here, but their processes are emanating in a variety of directions. This is a cell growing on astrocytes that were pre-plated onto a smooth substrate. So then we can look at, again, and try to quantitate what those cells are doing. So we can look at alignment, and then in addition, we can look at the proportion of cells that are differentiating and expressing some of these markers. And what was a very interesting result that fell out of this was that if we look at the neural stem cells only and growing them on a pattern or a non-pattern or smooth substrate, and here we're looking at the percentage of cells that are expressing, that can be labeled with the TUJ1, the neuronal marker. So in a loose sense, we're looking at the production of neurons under these conditions. So here it's essentially the same growing on a pattern or a non-pattern substrate when we have the neural stem cells by themselves. In contrast, when we have an astrocyte monolayer initially and then plate the cells on top of that, you can see there's a tremendous, significantly enhanced proportion of the cells are now expressing the neuronal marker compared to the other condition on the non-pattern substrate. So it seems as though that, in fact, the substrate can influence when you co-culture with these astrocytes. The astrocytes are providing some factors, and possibly the substrate environment, the physical environment also, are providing some information that stimulates or induces the cells to start to differentiate towards a neuronal cell fate. So in the field of neural stem cell biology, people often use antibody markers or various markers to identify the different cell types. But a neuron is a very specialized, very unique cell type, and it has a very specific function. So another approach that I think is very, very important and is very critical and is often lacking in studies is to look at the functional properties of these cells. And so here what we have is a pattern substrate and cells growing on a pattern substrate that have been stained with a neuronal marker. So here now we've switched to fluorescence, and you can see these cells are nicely aligned here. Well, let's try and record from those cells and look at their membrane properties to see if they really are expressing a neuronal phenotype. So we're using a technique here called whole cell voltage clamp recording. So it's just schematized here. Here's a cell, maybe a neuron, growing on a substrate. We come in with a microelectrode that has a very highly polished tip, and we're going to press that tightly against the membrane of the cell and then create a little bit of negative pressure, a little bit of suction on the back of the electrode. And so now the seal becomes even tighter. It's in the gigaseal, gigaohm range, a very, very tight seal electrically. A little bit of the membrane becomes deformed up into that, to the pipette. And then we can apply even a little bit more suction, and what we want to do is rupture that membrane right there. So we rupture the membrane. Now we have continuity between the intracellular environment of the cell and the electrode itself. So the pathway of least resistance in terms of electrical currents is going to be into this pipette where we can record the electrical activity in response to our stimulus. So we're going to use this approach now to look at some of these cells. So here we have some cells growing on a pattern substrate along with astrocytes. Here's a cell that under phase microscopy looks sort of like a neuron based on its morphology. Bring up our electrode, patch onto that cell, create a tight seal, rupture the membrane inside the orifice of the electrode, and now we can do whole cell recording, and then this is the type of result that we look for. So down below, this is a family of the stimulus pulses. So we hold the membrane potential of the cell at some defined value, in this case around minus 75 millivolts, would be a conventional membrane potential for a neuronal type cell. We then give voltage, depolarizing voltage steps, and then look at the currents in response to those depolarizing steps. So up here, what you can see is this would be a cell, a recording from a cell after 7 days under these conditions. And what we see are these very prominent currents. In this case, upward is outward currents. So these are very prominent. As we increase the depolarizing steps, we see larger and larger outward currents. And it turns out that if we do pharmacological studies and use pharmacological reagents to block different channels, we find that these outward conductances are carried by potassium ions. So this typical outward conductance like this, delayed, long-lasting outward potassium conductance is very typical of progenitor cells and glial cells. So this was at 7 days under these conditions. If we let the cultures go longer and then do the same type of experiment, we see, not always, but in many cases, we see cells that still display these outward conductances, these maintained outward potassium conductances, but you can see there's possibly multiple components. There's a fast transient component, and then this delayed, sustained portion of the current. So it turns out that this earlier portion is sensitive to, it's also due to potassium, but it's sensitive to a different channel blocker compared to the sustained portion. But the most interesting part that I'd like you to note is, see right here, there's just maybe a hint of a little blip right there, but here, it's considerably larger. It's a very fast, transient, inward current, and if we do the pharmacological studies, we can show that this inward current is due to sodium ions. So a neuron, a cell, like a neuron that's capable of producing action potentials, has often, generally, has a fast transient inward sodium conductance. So using this type of approach, we can verify that these cells have these types of membrane properties that are associated with neurons. So many of the cells that we can patch onto after 14 days in vitro under these conditions do in fact, although they, not only do they have the morphology and express many of the proteins that are associated with specific cell classes, but we can also record for the cells and look at their physiological properties.
Do they also have the sodium potassium pumps?
Yes. Well, we don't know for sure, but we presume. Everything has to be tested. Another important. Yeah, and also if these cells can respond to specific ligands, neurotransmitters, glutamate, GABA, things like that, and see what their conductances are, will also tell us a lot about the neurons, the properties of these cells. A neuron is not a neuron is not a neuron. In your brain, you don't have just neurons. You have subclasses of neurons. Some neurons respond to certain neurotransmitters, and others respond to other neurotransmitters. So it's a very, you know, complex environment sitting in your brain. Variety of neuronal cell types, variety of transmitters and peptides that can excite those cells or inhibit those cells. So, you know, it's important to characterize them more than simply like this, but to look at the cells in much greater detail to try to identify, you know, what types of chemicals and neurotransmitters can stimulate those cells, and what types of cells are actually differentiating, what type of a neuron the cells are differentiating into. So I think I'm going to, I think that's, yes. And Howard's going to tell you a little bit about some of our efforts to try and model some of these events, developmental processes based on our in vitro studies.
Okay, well, okay, so, okay, so I guess we'll begin here. So the big problem is to, from the point of view of the mathematician, is again, as I said on Monday, is to make the mathematics tell the biologist something that he or she doesn't already know. So we kick these ideas around trying to find two modeling ideas which we want to lead to testable hypotheses. And so the first thing was to try to understand the mechanism from progenitor cell to differentiated cell, some kind of simplified mechanism for that. And so we proposed two models, and I'll show you this one in detail, and this one I'll just indicate a little bit. So the first one is to have a signal that directs a progenitor to differentiate, and this one would be an indirect signal, and I'll show you. So in the direct signal differentiated cell mechanism, we have the working hypothesis that a stem cell will differentiate when the serum level of growth factor concentration is less than some threshold. There's not enough growth factor to cause the cell to differentiate to proliferate, so it goes into G0 and it differentiates. And when it's above this threshold, the cell will enter the cell cycle.
So that's the combination of a bunch of growth factors, or specifically one growth factor?
Well, in the model, we just do one,
okay.
But because we just want to develop
so it's
the math.
That's
right.
So
yeah,
okay.
I mean, and I certainly don't know. I think if I build a model with one, then we can see how we could add the model. So a signal to differentiate then is regarded as a lack of growth factor. So that's a signal. Okay, so if you have a receptor, a progenitor receptor bound to growth factor, then the cell cycle is activated, so that's the proliferation stage. And the absence of V results in the initiation of differentiation. So the concentration of the signal is then the maximum concentration of the growth factor less the growth factor that's already there. So that was a strange kind of way of thinking of a signal, but as a lack of something, but it seems to... it seems to make some kind of mathematical sense. So the chemical equation is that the signal plus a receptor of a progenitor type produces a receptor of a differentiated cell type. So that's the model. Yeah?
Isn't it a bit strange to say that signal for differentiation is a lack of signal? Because you would think that, I mean, if the cell doesn't get a signal, that we die, for instance, instead of differentiate, or...
Where's Don when I
need him?
Okay.
The easiest way for us to, the easiest and least complicated for us, what method to start those cells to differentiate is, you don't grow them in serum, you grow them in a defined medium that's supplemented with growth factors. So when we then grow those cells in that same exact media but without the growth factors, after within a couple of days we start to see now cells that are expressing more differentiated phenotypes. So we could also stimulate differentiation by adding other factors, some neurotrophic growth factors, BDNF, GDNF, things like that, retinoic acid, but sort of in a simple, in a simplistic view, just removing the growth factor that stimulates the cells and maintains them as progenitor cells. By just removing that factor, you can push the cells to start differentiating.
It might help you to think of a progenitor cell as the ultimate differentiated cell. So it need to so you can flip it the other way. So all cells really are differentiated, but progenitor cells have this incredible capacity, and so they require this growth factor to maintain their differentiated ability to differentiate, sort of. Does that make any sense? It's sort of the other way of looking at it.
It's
maybe
the flip side of the coin.
Or it's the flip side of the coin of,
yeah,
if you have, if it's the ultimate not differentiated cell, which you have, and the whole issue of either you're dividing or you're migrating, differentiating, then you need to, if he shows that you can take away a growth factor to prevent dividing and cause differentiating, it's sort of.
But then we use it the other way around.
Yeah.
Add growth factors to the
But when you,
wow,
you
this
combine,
I mean,
migration.
Your discussion clearly shows the confusion in our minds when we start to think about,
yeah,
this.
There's the old saying that a hen is an egg's way of making another egg.
Anyway, so did you have a question? Oh, okay. So anyway, since I like kinetics, I thought, well, I'll just think of this signal plus receptor, progenitor receptor goes to differentiated cell receptor. And now the rate constant, which is in quotes here, is to be thought of as time dependent, actually as growth factor dependent. And so that's sort of the new wrinkle, if you like. And so I'm going to describe that. So the rate constant becomes a switch that depends on the local concentration of growth factor. That's the idea here. So as I've introduced a threshold level and the maximum amount of growth factor in the serum, and the switch can only be activated when the concentration of the activating molecule V is present in some minimal concentration. That is to say, the rate constant is proportional to the heavy side function of some threshold minus the concentration of the growth factor. So if this is, you remember what H is, it's the function which is zero when the argument is negative and one when the argument is positive. And so when V is bigger than V0, this is negative and the switch is off. And when V is less than V0, this is one, this guy is positive and the switch is on, and so that starts the proliferation, that starts the differentiation. So that's the simple idea, the naive simple idea. Okay? Now that's not the whole story, because when the switch is on, then it takes a certain amount of time for the receptor that's activated then to go into the cell cycle and go to signal the cell to differentiate, right? There's a lag time. Okay, so we have to put that in here, and so there is an additional lag for signal transduction, and I just call that SK1 as the lag time.
But that would not work for bypassing responses.
By what?
But, you know, whether you have a response that doesn't reach a max and go down.
Well, it's just a measure of the time from from, yeah, I just.
You're even just your approach in a max.
Yeah, but.
Many of these growth factors will have bypassing responses. You may have it increase the effect, and then when it goes down, when it's a higher concentration.
Well, if the concentration is high, you don't have the differentiate. If the growth factor concentration is high, you don't have the switch on.
Well, what she's saying is the growth factor concentration from 0 to 10, let's say.
Yeah.
As it goes from 0 to 2.5, you have a peak, it goes.
Well, it doesn't go from 0. It goes the other way. If you start out, if you plot time this way, then the growth factor is some V max. And then it's that there's some V zero. And so what's happening is you don't get it until it gets down.
Right.
Below.
Right. But some of the growth factors they have effects depends on the concentration. At a low concentration they have a positive effect, and then a middle kind of concentration they lack it, and then it happens again when
it's
high concentration.
Yeah, okay, so what you're saying is that we need some kind of additional band in here to measure that. But this is just
instead of being that type of function, you have to put something that reflects the going up and down and the effect.
Yeah, okay. I guess I better talk to you next week about this. Oh, you mean that? Are you referring to a kind of a saturating curve?
No, not a saturating curve.
Oh, if the growth factor does this.
Yeah.
Well, that's the point. Okay. Because what we're going to see in a few seconds is that the model will allow for something like this.
Yeah.
In concentration of growth factor. Yeah, that's right, and that's what's coming. So so anyway. So anyway, suppose the concentration of growth factor crosses the threshold at a sequence of times. Okay, so in a picture like that. So we have something like that. So suppose V zero is up here, it falls below, it comes above, falls below, goes above, and you have these sequences of times, T1, T2, T3, and so on. So you, okay? You see, I mean, it's a construct. It's okay. And then the idea is that, I'm afraid to press these buttons. Okay. So basically, if the concentration of growth factor is initially Vmax, then on even indices it crosses V0 from below, while on odd indices T, it crosses V0 from above, and so that determines the sign of this guy to be positive or negative on these intervals and positive on these intervals, and that's the successive on-off of this possibility of on-off of the switch. Does that help? So now the formula then for K1 of T, if you track this out, turns out to be that K1 of T is K1 of, and now it's V0 minus V at T minus the lag time for this signal transduction. So that's the formula that one wants to use for the rate constant. I hate to use the word constant. The rate function, let's call it the rate function. Okay. So to find these TIs numerically, you have to monitor the growth factor. You have to monitor the concentration of growth factor as the dynamics progresses, because these TI cannot be found, at least mathematically, other than by solution of the differential equations that come from that simple mechanism, which I'm now going to show you. Okay, so that's sort of the model. Okay, so let's see what it is.
So that could you have two different concentrations?
You mean two different concentrations?
The model will allow two different concentrations having the same effect.
In principle, I don't know, because I haven't tested this model. You mean two different initial concentrations or two different source concentrations? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, because of the.
Well, I think from a point of view of differential equations, the solution's unique if the source is, if everything is given in one way. But change, if you change the growth factor rate, you should get a different outcome. Okay, so let me just talk a little bit about the dynamics. Okay, so there may also be some environmentally sourced for the signal, maybe entering the model or disappearing from the model at a certain rate. Okay, so if you write down these the differential equations, then what one has is that the signal is being consumed at a certain rate, k1 of t. You remember the equation was s plus rp is going to rd. So just by naive mass action, this is the consumption term for the signal. This is the source, and presumably the signal has a natural rate of decay. The production of receptors is simply k1 of t times the receptor concentration of the progenitors times s. And then for the production of progenitor cell receptors, this is its consumption from this simple equation. And then what we've added here is a growth factor dependent, so this is a kind of a logistic term, but we've added a growth factor signal dependent coefficient, which is then multiplied by 1 minus k1 over capital K1. So in other words, when this is on, this is off, and when this is off, this is on. Okay, so you either go from differentiation to proliferation or back, depending on whether K1 is positive or K1 is positive or K1 is zero. So this K1. So this is a normal. This is either one. This fraction is either one or zero. So if it's on, this is one or it's capital K1 and then this is zero, and if it's off, this is zero and then this is on. So that's the philosophy. It's a very simple idea, I certainly admit, but it's the first one that seems to sort of translate this the verbal statements about differentiation versus proliferation into mathematics that I can think of, the simplest one I can think of.
Can I just ask a simple question?
Sure.
K1 is just the response function to whatever factor.
Yeah, it's just some constant times the Heaviside function of this guy.
So to incorporate the biphasic response, you need some sort of rule of once K is above this.
Yeah, and that's incorporated in these numbers, right? These TIs. Okay, it's either above or below. But the problem is you don't know the TIs until you get the solution V. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is, if I go back here, is that that in this well, let me write the equation for V first. Okay, so if you write the equation for B right by the system in terms of growth factor, you write the signal is V, concentration of signal is V max minus V, and you go back and put that variable in instead of wherever S appears. Now at least it's in terms of something positive and instead of something negative. In other words, it's a real molecule rather than the absence of a molecule. And then you see, so here you see, for example, if I take away that term, I have the decay and the consumption of growth factor, depending on the rate constant, or the rate function, which also depends on V because it depends on these times. And then if the signal is being produced, it means the growth factor is being used up. So the source for the signal is the negative, is a sink for the growth factor. Okay, and here are just these other terms. And again, here if this is K capital K1, then this is zero, and vice versa. So that's the idea. Okay, that's the simple idea. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So if you stare at that system long enough, you see that as the growth factor concentration is driven to zero, which will occur if the sink and the decay rate is large enough, then you should get some kind of a steady state, we think. And diffusion and chemical potential terms that reflect chemotactic, chemokinetic, or haptotactic influences on cell movement can be incorporated incorporated in these models as indicated by, as dictated by geometrical considerations. So we have to put this well-stirred model. You think of this as a kind of it's an ODE model, so I think of it as a well-stirred pot. Then you have to put it in spatial dependence. So for example, we can look then at what would be predicted by the groove models that Don talked about. Okay. then we have to put extra terms in that reflect diffusion and chemical gradients and all that sort of business. I didn't do that here because that has become for as you've seen from listening to modelers all week long, that's sort of standard. Okay, but so I just wanted to present this side. This is a possibility. Of a new way of thinking about cell differentiation versus proliferation for stem cells. So that's the, okay. Okay, with the indirect, it gets a little more complicated, and I guess I think I'm gonna quit, okay, because the indirect is a little more complicated. But basically there you have this binding producing an enzyme. The enzyme degrades a matrix. The matrix produces an inhibitor. The inhibitor provides the action for binding with a receptor of a progenitor cell, and that ultimately leads to the differentiated cell. So that's a little more complicated model. And hopefully that when we look at the output from both of these models, that is to say the in silico output, we should see something different about both models that one can perhaps verify in the laboratory. And that, in a nutshell, is the idea. That's what we want to do, right? The biologists are the bosses here, so I'm trying to do the thing. Question?
So, in a different lifetime, about 20 years ago, we were growing something called embryonal carcinoma. It's a pterocarcinoma stem cell. So for the purposes of the present discussion, you could just say it's a mouse stem cell.
Okay.
We can get an abort. And if we grew that cell in standard culture conditions, about 1% of the cells would differentiate into neuronal cells,
yeah,
as judged by that was when that antibody was developed, the tubulin antibody. We were at Virginia when that antibody was developed. Okay, so, and if you grew them on laminin, the progenitor cells now, and there was a way of keeping a very pure population of progenitors, they would, so instead of taking, say, 2 weeks to make 1% neuronal, it'll take 3 days to make 50% neuronal-like cells, as judged by this tubulin antibody. And then we could fiddle a little bit more, like I think we put in something that inhibited cyclic AMP pathways, and it boosted it. So you could slowly creep up on more. And they had neurites, and they had some of them look like they were actually axonal, and they had, what do they call them, the nose,
varicosities.
Yeah, varicosities, yeah. And I'm not a neurobiologist, but the point I'm trying to make is that the most profound effect that was ever observed on these cells was just a simple, and we purified the laminin, so there's no baloney about, oh, the laminin had some growth factor.
Okay.
We purified it, the homogeneity from that same mouse tumor that Major Joe comes from.
Single type.
Well, the HS2, that tumor has predominantly one kind of laminin. What I'm trying to say is that there weren't, GFPs and but anyway, the point I want to make is that just the simple presence of three-dimensional laminin changed that again from, say, 2 to 3 weeks, 1% cells, to 2-3 days, 50% neuronal cells. Just that.
So the laminin may be...
Well, I just found it's an empirical observation.
Yeah, but that's interesting. Yeah. Of course, I use growth factor here, but really,
there's
just some signal.
There's serum presence.
Yeah, yeah.
They say there's fetal bovine serum in all cases. Everything I just said is always present. I'm just trying to make the point that the laminin had absolutely profound effect on the degree of neuronal.
So that's an indicator that maybe the more complicated model is, because that's the one that involves the laminin.
What other thing you have? That also should play a role as well.
As a stimulator.
That
try to define the conditions, the vast majority of experiments we're conducting are in defined media without serum.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we can add known concentrations of these factors.
Okay. That's better.
We've looked at different progenitors have different properties and what they can do and different proportions of cells that can differentiate into neurons versus glial. And for example, some of the cells that we work with, we've compared their growth on laminin, purified laminin, fibronectin, collagen, or just polyornithin. And in some cases, we see some subtle differences. In other cases, it doesn't really matter what the substrate was. The cells still, the same proportion of cells are expressing the different neuronal glial markers. We were hoping to find some profound differences like that. But when we look at the expression of what integrins the cells are expressing, they express, we've never, using PCR or antibodies, we haven't seen them not expressing any of the tests so far.
Yeah, you're already starting with presumably a neuronal lineage, right?
Yeah, we weren't.
Yeah. I mean, these guys can make smooth, they can make cardiac muscle, they can do the whole. They were coding them.
These
are multiple, I guess. So. Right. Is that the jargon?
Yeah, I mean, they're further down.
Oh, much further.
The hierarchy of